It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Charles Darwin, the father of the theory of evolution, was born on February 12, 1809. Over the last 20 years, there's been a movement afoot to establish an International Darwin Day that would be celebrated around the world. That grand vision hasn't quite been realized, but there are groups all over the world who have been organizing annual Darwin Day celebrations. One of those groups is in Iowa City. This year's Darwin Day celebration in Iowa City is actually 3 days long, February 5th through the 7th. And this hour, three of the participants are here with me to talk about Darwin, science, and their own research. Maureen Neiman is Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa and President-elect of Darwin Day. Hello, Maureen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here today. Andrew Forbes is here, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Biology and Co-Academic Coordinator of U of I's Environmental Science Program. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome back to the show. And Sean Carroll is here. He's an evolutionary biologist and very well-known author. He's a professor of molecular biology and genetics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, VP of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which is a private supporter of science education. He'll be speaking at this year's Darwin Day event. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Charity. That was a mouthful.
Yeah. I won't say it again, I promise. But thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk about the origins of this celebration in Iowa City. Maureen, as president-elect, what is your goal with Darwin Day in Iowa City?
Our goal is to celebrate science in a way that's accessible and fun to the public and also makes clear the importance of science and of evolutionary science to humans and to the world and the problems that we face, and to do it in a way that's comfortable and engaging to the public and show them that scientists are real people and that the work we do takes place in a context that's shaped by the world around us as well.
How long has Darwin Day been going on in Iowa City?
It was founded in 2007 by a pair of non-biologist intellectuals, John Stamler, who's an MD PhD ophthalmologist, and his wife, Virginia Stamler, who is a PhD psychologist and therapist. And the two of them are extremely broad-minded, smart, fun people who really love science and really wanted to bring an appreciation and a celebration of science to their community. They love Iowa City, and they got this going in 2007, the year before I came here, and they started recruiting people interested in evolutionary science from the University of Iowa community and beyond, and we've been going ever since.
All right, and growing ever since.
Growing quite a lot, yeah. We've got a very large group of organizers and then an even larger group of volunteers that includes students and people from the community, and we've brought in amazing speakers every year. At least every year I've been here, we've had really exciting people coming in to talk about origin of birds from dinosaurs or the search for life on other planets, all sorts of just amazing speakers, and no different this year either.
Well, and Sean, let's start by talking about the life of Charles Darwin, and we could spend all hour and more than an hour talking about the life of Charles Darwin. But I think this is a name that almost everybody is familiar with. People know something about evolution, even if it only goes as far as knowing theory of evolution, and it pretty much ends there. But what should the general public know about Charles Darwin?
Well, I'd take a stab that I think the public image of Darwin is probably this gray-bearded, you know, elderly man, kind of in his Karl Marx-looking phase, you know, who somehow had these ideas that upset everybody. And I think you got to shift that picture entirely to a 22-year-old new college graduate who gambled by going on this, what was supposed to be a 2-year boat voyage that turned into 5 years going around the world, and who left behind his loved ones and faced the dangers of being in a Navy boat on the open seas in the 1830s and saw things as he went around the world that changed his perspective entirely from what he had been taught in England. And so what I try to do when talking about Darwin, particularly I'm often in front of younger audiences, including students, is to just relate that fact. I mean, everybody can think of themselves at 22. It's not that remote. Just imagine what it's like to go off into the unknown and the thrill of going where others had not gone before and of thinking things that people had not thought before. And that's really the story of Darwin. It's a young man, you know, sort of confronting the real world as opposed to, you know, an old man, you know, writing books.
You know, at the point at which he took that voyage, I think it's hard for us to imagine the state of science and to understand really what kind of basis he had for forming his theories and for his understanding of the natural world. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of where he was starting?
Well, a really important ingredient for Darwin was geology, and he would even describe himself as a geologist, because before the voyage, he had had the chance to study and go out into the field with one of England's great geologists. And if you think about sort of what was going on with the Industrial Revolution, you know, it was really, the knowledge of geology was really important, because that was where, that's how you found, you know, coal seams, and that's how you found other valuable, you know, deposits, mineral deposits and things like that. And, of course, in the realm of physics, you know, the sort of the revolution in physics had already taken place. So our picture of the sort of our solar system had been changing. Our picture of the Earth had been changing, and understanding things like the role of erosion in sculpting the seacoast, the role of how mountain chains were built and things like this. And so this very much more dynamic picture of nature was coming from geology, and some of the, you know, basic laws of physics were already in hand, but biology had no such thing. There were really, you know, no observations that had sort of crystallized our picture of what life was all about. But this was a time when, you know, the thought entered Darwin's mind and others that there must be some rules, some laws that govern life. And he didn't go out in the world, he didn't go out on the boat ride necessarily thinking, you know, that he was the one that was going to discover them. But as he read and thought, he, you know, sort of started to ponder what might some of those rules and laws be that govern life, and why wouldn't life be governed by laws just like everything else? I think that's probably the most important leap in terms of the science background. Was, you know, this was a really exciting age for science that it hadn't hit biology yet, and Darwin really was, along with some of his contemporaries like Alfred Russel Wallace, you know, one of the first interpreters of the real world, you know, in a way that has, you know, stuck for the next 150 years.
We know Charles Darwin as the father of the theory of evolution. How long did it take from that journey on the Beagle for him to put his theory together and to release it to the public?
Now, that's two different questions. It's because he put the theory together really in about 2 years. So it started, the pennies started to drop. He started to make sense of things just on his voyage home, the long leg home, in 1836. And then in the first 2 years on land, and boy, was he happy to get back on land since he suffered seasickness the whole 5 years, on land in England the first 2 years, really the major ideas crystallized. And we have documents, both notebooks and then subsequent writings, that those manuscripts are still in existence, which tell us that he had put the ideas together. But it was 20 years before he published them, first in a very short piece, and then finally as in The Origin of Species. So the ideas came to him and crystallized early, but he wasn't, and he wrote them up first in a sort of maybe a 35-page form, then in more than 200 pages, but he did not share that with the scientific world for almost 20 years.
Now, the theory of evolution is something that still causes controversy today. Can you, I think that a lot of people use the word evolution without actually understanding the theory. Can you give us just a brief nutshell encapsulation of evolution by natural selection?
Well, let's just start with evolution. Evolution is just change over time. So the simplest thing for anyone to observe is that life has changed over time. Just drill into the crust of the earth, walk through a, you know, drive through a road cut, and we can see that the organisms that are buried in the crust of the earth are different at different time intervals. So there's no doubt that life has changed over time. How has life changed over time? You know, what are the mechanisms that have enabled that? That's you know, the next level question. And Darwin's theory of natural selection describes basically a competitive process where those organisms in a group that are better able to reproduce and to survive, they give rise to more offspring, and their characteristics are preferentially passed on in this sort of competitive process, so that, you know, populations eventually change to have the characteristics that are most adaptive, best fit for their environment. And so this natural selection is a really simple idea. It's just this competition among different varieties. And, you know, nature is the arbiter of what is the most competitive variety. And that process compounded over, and just say in the course of the animal kingdom for almost 600 million years, you know, has given us the great variety of life that we see today.
I have found that there are many people who are very excited about talking about Charles Darwin, and a lot of biologists, a lot of scientists, a lot of people who just enjoy science have enjoyed biographies of him and many interesting facts. So, Sean, I'll let you start. Do you have a favorite Darwin fun fact, one of your favorite stories?
Oh, that's pretty tricky. I think the fun thing about Darwin is, you know, he was father to 10 children, 7 of whom survived to adulthood. And so the fun fact was his life back in England was so domestic. I mean, he was just a homebody, did all of his work out of his own study, out of his own house, conducted his experiments on the grounds of his house, surrounded by children, doting children who adored him. And he was just a really sweet, good-natured, loving person. And he had this, amazing life of, inquiry, scientific inquiry, surrounded by the people he loved.
We're talking about Charles Darwin today, inspired by the upcoming Darwin Day celebration in Iowa City, which is coming up February 5th through the 7th. With me, Sean Carroll, an evolutionary biologist and author. His most recent book is Brave Genius. He'll be speaking at the Darwin Day celebration. Andrew Forbes is also here, UI Assistant Professor of Biology. Maureen Neiman is here, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa. She's also President-elect of Darwin Day. We'll talk about science education in our schools, understanding of science in our general society. We'll talk about science reporting in the media, and we'll also talk about some of the research that my guests have been involved in. And you can join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also find out more about the Darwin Day celebration by following the link on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Charles Darwin. We're talking about evolutionary biology, science in education, science and the public understanding of science. And you are welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And we do have a link on our Facebook page to information about the Iowa City Darwin Day, which is coming up February 5th through the 7th. With me this hour, Maureen Neiman. She's an associate professor of biology at the University of Iowa and president-elect of Darwin Day. Andrew Forbes is University of Iowa assistant professor of biology. And Sean Carroll is an evolutionary biologist and very well-known author. His most recent book is Brave Genius. He will be presenting at Darwin Day this year. And before we move off the subject of Charles Darwin himself, we have a caller with a question for you, Sean. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, this is Wayne.
Right. What's your question?
Well, I was just curious if there was a story about the 20-year gap between him returning from his trip and publishing to the science community.
Yeah, thanks, Wayne. That's a great question, and historians have had a field day with it. So I'll just give you my take, because I've spent a lot of time studying original Darwin documents and reading what everybody else had to say. It's a combination of factors, I think, that held him back. On the one hand, if a young man looking to make his reputation, you might think he would disclose this theory. But he knew that this theory was going to upset everybody, and he was concerned for a variety of reasons. One, that maybe he didn't have enough evidence. Second of all, and I think this is, in my mind, substantial, that he had married, for example, his first cousin, and she was a devout Christian, and she worried what the implications of this theory were for both their relationship and for their future in eternity together. And also, he was educated at Cambridge, and all of his professors were, as was the case at the time, were ordained clergy in the Anglican Church. And he knew how they would feel about this, and he felt very loyal and towards all of his teachers who made, for example, the voyage possible. And I think he felt it would have been like spitting in their face to just come out with a theory, you know, based on the amount of evidence that he had. So I think it was a combination of things. And also, he had written an account of his voyage on the Beagle that had become popular. And so Darwin's reputation was growing, and the collections he had made on the Beagle had earned him a great reputation, and he was becoming a prolific writer and naturalist in other areas. So really, I think that, you know, things were going quite well for Darwin, and he decided not to roll the dice on his big theory and put at risk all of these relationships as well as his reputation.
And what happened to him personally when he released the theory?
Pretty much what was expected. Now, he had disclosed his ideas to a few confidants over those 20 years, and he had used them as sounding boards and honed his argument, and such that, you know, we all recognize, biologists recognize, The Origin of Species is a masterful work. It argues, you know, all sides of any particular perspective and what the meaning of various evidence. It's really a brilliant piece of writing and analysis, but the implications were quite clear. And the fundamental implication, I mean, what upsets everybody about Darwin's idea of evolution is that it says the origin of species is natural, not divine. And that, you know, the divine origin of species was the prevailing view for, you know, the previous centuries, was that species were placed on Earth by God in their present form, you know, unchanging, you know, according to the Creator's wishes, and not the consequence of natural processes taking place on the planet. And so that, you know, Darwin's idea was, you know, quickly interpreted by theologians as, you know, at least putting the Creator at a more distant position in the course of life on Earth. Some accepted that relatively readily, and some, of course, hold out against that today.
Andrew?
I just wanted to add that one of the things that I think is so exciting about the story of him waiting so long and then releasing it is that it seems like the only reason he eventually publishes is because someone else comes along who has come up with the same idea but has a lot less to lose, and sends Darwin a letter or this copy of this manuscript that puts forward this idea, and Darwin goes, oh no, I'm going to be scooped. And so they eventually present these two papers, the same idea, together at this meeting. It's sort of unclear how long he would have continued to wait. I mean, maybe Sean knows more about that. But
no, that's a great point Andrew makes. So what happened was Alfred Russel Wallace, who was younger than Darwin, but by 1858 had spent his own 10 years out in jungles, I guess maybe 8 years out in jungles, first in the Amazon and then the Malay Archipelago, essentially came up with the same idea of natural selection and sent his idea to Darwin, saying, if you think it's worthy, you know, could you see that it's published? And Darwin thought, yeah, it's certainly worthy. And then it was worked out that they were published together. And that was just a fragment of Darwin's work, because he had this whole book that was going to come out the next year. I think Darwin would have held on longer. I think Andrew's definitely right that the catalyst to eventually publishing and publishing The Origin of Species, the book we know, in a hurry, was that, in fact, Wallace had come up with a similar idea. And right in the first page of The Origin of Species, you know, Darwin acknowledges Wallace's contribution. So, in fact, in Darwin and Wallace's day, and Wallace outlived Darwin by 30 years, this was known as the Darwin-Wallace theory of evolution. Historians, and I'm sad to say probably biologists and educators, have lost track of Mr. Wallace. And I'm a big admirer of Alfred Wallace as well as of Darwin. And it's, you know, we've been talking about stories here in the first few minutes. Well, Wallace's story is a fantastic story, and he was somebody with a lot less to lose than Darwin, and he was very bold in his writings, including writings that preceded this 1858 disclosure of natural selection. So there's a lot more to the story of how the idea of evolution, you know, sort of became presented to the world.
Maureen, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I had a related point that really would turn into a question or a hope that Sean could maybe expand with his greater expertise in this area. But Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was a prominent abolitionist. And there, with all of the attention being paid in the last few weeks and months to issues of social justice here in the United States with the Ferguson trial and Martin Luther King Day and the release of Selma, I thought it would be interesting to comment on the extent to which Darwin's ideas shaped his own thoughts about social justice and the equality of people, and how he was hoping that his ideas might actually contribute towards making the world a better place from that perspective.
Yeah, I think Maureen's brought another really interesting angle of Darwin's view. Yes, his grandfather was an abolitionist, and when Darwin went around the world and saw the use of slaves in British colonies, he was absolutely horrified, and he was so vocal about it that the captain of the Beagle, Fitzroy, who had taken him along on this voyage, almost kicked him off the boat. So Fitzroy was a traditionalist. He sort of, you know, towed the line. Darwin thought that that slavery was an abomination. And he, and the way he saw slaves being treated, you know, only reinforced that. So he was a determined abolitionist. And as his biological ideas evolved, of course, he realized that, you know, we were all one species, and that what, you know, people had been subdividing, you know, in this class system of England, and thinking of some people as, you know, beneath others. You know, Darwin didn't accept that view whatsoever, and he realized it was really just a matter of education and upbringing that, you know, that made the differences between people. So his biological ideas and his ideas of social justice were definitely intertwined, and there's some long, fascinating correspondence between Darwin and an American botanist named Asa Gray on the eve of the Civil War, because, it, you know, the shame being, or essentially the crisis being, that, you know, now it's in we're looking at civil war in the United States and a very strange relationship with Britain, you know, over this issue of slavery. And so this was foremost on Darwin's mind. And I think I can't point to any particular writings. It's really sort of accumulated impression you get from lots and lots of different correspondence that, you know, I think Darwin hoped that people could come to see, you know, Homo sapiens as one species, you know, and all of us essentially of, to kind of quote our own Constitution and Declaration of Independence, you know, as one species with everyone of equal importance and standing.
Well, and it's an important point to make, because Darwin's research was corrupted by some other people later on in the eugenics movement and in other different ways, trying to use our knowledge of evolution to really, I guess, manage the human species in different ways. That was not Darwin's goal, and that was not his belief. I want to talk about beliefs a little bit here, because, of course, as you mentioned, I mean, Darwin knew he was sitting on something that was explosive, that a lot of people of faith were going to have a really hard time with. People of faith today sometimes have a really hard time with evolution. There is still this conflict over the teaching of evolution in schools. This conflict has been going on for so long. I want to ask all three of you to respond to, do you feel like faith and the belief and the understanding of the theory of evolution has to be at odds? And Sean, I'll let you start.
Well, I'll just give it as an, I'll take this as an observer, not so much, you know, my personal take on things, but I'll announce a personal background. I went to a Catholic high school. I was raised in Ohio. I learned evolution, you know, no fine print, you know, all the principles, et cetera. And that's been the teaching, for example, in Catholic schools for more than 60 years. So just that fact alone, and that's the largest Christian denomination on the planet. So that just fact alone tells you that there are, not in addition to Roman Catholics, there are many, many denominations who are perfectly comfortable with the teaching of evolution. And this fact is largely missing, I think, from the public perception in how this issue gets treated in the media. Very often in the media, it's a more polarized situation where someone who is absolutely, resolutely opposed to evolution is, you know, pitted with an evolutionary biologist, you know, in 6 minutes of, you know, he said, she said kind of conversation. That's just not the picture, I think, where, including the United States, where a very large number of Americans stand, and that both their faith and their science are important to them. And some have managed, I think, to, you know, both articulate and sort of work out the domains of each of those areas of thought. And I point again to the Roman Catholic Church, because I think they wrestled with this early and figured out, you know, how to deal with biological evolution and how to deal with religious doctrine in a way that you know, is perfectly comfortable in their schools, is perfectly comfortable in their pulpit, and that, you know, practicing Catholics can be pretty much comfortable with. As I said, there's many more denominations like that. So I just throw that out there as a fact that, no, they don't have to be in conflict. Many, many denominations have resolved that conflict and, you know, comfortably coexist with the scientific ideas.
Anybody else want to add to that?
Yeah. I want to say that the phenomenon appears to be somewhat unique to the United States as well. There was a survey that went out, and then the results were published in the, I think, 2008, 2009, where they asked people from across a number of different countries, something like 80 different countries around the world, do you accept and believe in the theory of evolution? And, you know, most countries were 70, 80, 90% of the population said yes. And these are religious countries. You know, they are various denominations. And the U.S. is second from the bottom between, like, Cyprus and Turkey, something like that. So it's odd. It's sort of a strange thing, and we're unique among lots of different countries in the world.
Do you have a theory as to why that is?
No, I mean I don't know. We're an interesting country.
Marie?
I often teach evolution at the University of Iowa. We have evolution as a required course for all of our biology majors, which I think is wonderful and important. And I have wanted to say that I've never once in the probably 7 or 8 times that I've taught this course had a student who expressed discomfort to me either in class or outside of class with the subject material, even though I am positive that many of these students do in fact have religious beliefs. And I think this in part speaks to the I've noticed a very pronounced ability of Iowans to really listen and to tolerate, to have some really great discussions, maybe having to do with the fact that we have these very early caucuses. Iowans grow up learning to listen to each other and to discuss. Mm-hmm. I also think it really reflects the fact that you can teach evolution in a way that I don't explicitly talk about evolution or belief systems at all. I teach evolution, and I don't think that it has to make people feel badly about what they do or don't believe, but I think that they need to learn that it happens and it's important, and especially if many of these people are growing up to be our physicians, our health professionals, we really want them to understand and to accept evolution. But I don't think we want to start by saying you have to abandon some beliefs that are very important to you in order to be able to accept this very important theory.
Well, Maureen, you mentioned politics, and I want to talk about science literacy in general in our public, not just about evolution, but there are many scientific topics that have become political footballs in this country. Climate change is one of them, but also vaccinations for children is another. And we see people on the far right often who want to deny climate science. We see people on the very far left who want to deny the science, the medical science behind vaccines. So I'm curious about the political dynamic and our understanding of science in our population. Maureen, do you want to respond to that?
Well, all I want to say is that for saying that we don't need to challenge people's belief systems when we teach evolution, I definitely do not want myself or someone I love to go to see a health professional who doesn't accept evolution. Vaccines, antibiotic resistance are evolutionary problems. Cancer is an evolutionary problem. Infectious diseases like Ebola and the flu are evolutionary problems. And I think that I would not want anybody that I cared about to see a doctor who didn't see things that way.
Is this a reflection of poor science education in this country? Andrew?
I guess the way I feel about it is that maybe it is. That people don't generally seem to have the tools or maybe just the inclination to go out and challenge these things or dig deeper into these things on their own. They're just listening to all these different talking heads. And I think having better science literacy would allow people, sort of empower people. Like, I can go and I can look this stuff up myself, and I can interpret and dig into this information and find out the truth. Certain things like that humans are causing global climate change, they're unimpeachable. But there's this crazy debate that we're having that that really everyone should fall down on one side if they looked at the evidence. But people just, for whatever reason, don't seem inclined to go look or don't have maybe the tools
to understand
they are
seeing.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about science literacy, science education, and the upcoming Darwin Day celebration in Iowa City, February 5th through the 7th. My guests today, Sean Carroll, evolutionary biologist and author. Andrew Forbes is an assistant professor of biology at the University of Iowa, and Maureen Neiman, associate professor of biology, also at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio this hour. We're talking about science literacy, science education, the upcoming Darwin Day celebration in Iowa City coming up February 5th through the 7th. With me, Maureen Neiman, associate professor of biology at the University of Iowa, Andrew Forbes, assistant professor of biology at the University of Iowa, and Sean Carroll, also an evolutionary biologist and author. He'll be speaking at this year's Darwin Day celebration. His most recent book is Brave Genius. And Sean, before the break, we were talking about science literacy in our general public, and I want to talk about science education because there has been really a renewed focus in our schools, at least rhetorically speaking, on STEM education, science education in our schools. Is this a response to something we were doing wrong?
Well, I think it's certainly a response to recognizing that those disciplines are pretty important from a variety of perspectives. Some folks who are maybe oriented towards the employment market think that that's a really important set of skills, and of course people think that those are really important ingredients for good citizenry. So I think there's an element there, and also some of the reforms going on in STEM education are also reflecting better understanding of how people learn. So the way science is being taught is changing in classrooms across the country. That's both K-12 as well as university classrooms, and recognizing that, you know, science is something best understood when you do it. I guess the best analogy I can give you is I got a son who's a music student, and if I told him or his pals that they couldn't touch an instrument for 2 years while they studied the theory of music, they'd go berserk. And yet in classrooms, students don't get a lot of experience of actually doing science hands-on and understanding, you know, what that process is about. So there's a much renewed emphasis, or maybe a greater emphasis than ever, on getting the process of science into classrooms and getting students exposed to that. So I think that can only be a good thing. If I can just pick up again with what we were talking about before the break for 1 second, sort of to focus in on the importance of science education. You know, the airwaves, we all know about these polarized voices about these various topics, but national polls are pretty interesting when you look at demographics. The acceptance of evolution, there's probably about a 20 percentage point difference between 18 to 30-year-olds and over 65-year-olds in the country, virtually the same 20-point distance between people who accept that climate change is happening and man-made versus those who don't, in the younger versus over 65. And I think that just reflects, like many things in the world, you know, change happens in the younger generations. And also, the younger generations are perhaps equipped with more information. My kids got exposed to more evolutionary science than I was, simply because we know a lot more 30 or 40 years later. This has been a golden age for evolutionary science. So the exposure to the fossil record, to understanding, you know, how we can see the process of evolution in the DNA record, things like this. If you're, you know, of a certain age, there was no possible exposure to this decades ago. And the teaching of evolution was very patchy in terms of curriculum standards. So I just think that current generations are going to be exposed to a lot more evidence. And, you know, at some point, we have to hope that evidence is a compelling thing.
You know, there is some amazing science journalism that goes on out there, and I've read many of your articles, Sean, but there is also a lot of journalism that is conducted by people who don't have a strong understanding of science. Do you think that that is a part of the problem in communicating scientific research to the general public?
Well, I think that's certainly, you know, that's a challenge. But I agree with you about the talent that's out there in terms of journalism and storytelling. I think that, you know, science is, you know, I look at it this way. I'm a big proponent of story as the way to communicate science. And science stories are competing with all sorts of other stories that grab people's interest. And so you know, we have to think about, you know, science's place in our culture and where do we learn, you know, how do we sort of get exposed to science as we would to any other sort of, you know, human activity. And it's gotten patchy. If I look at something like the TV landscape, I think that the quantity of quality science programming has diminished significantly over the last 10 or 15 years. That the cable networks that, for example, when they started, had a fair amount of science and nature content have gone to some pretty bizarre programming. And it's not that easy to find contemporary science stories in, for example, television, which is where most people still get their information about science. So, you know, this is going to sound like a shameless plug, but it's perhaps informative. You know, one of the reasons I went to Washington to head up science education with HHMI was, in fact, to do more public communication of science. We started a filmmaking unit. We've made documentary films, several of which aired in 2014, including, in fact, a film on the reemergence of vaccine-preventable diseases, which was on NOVA in September. So, and I think several science organizations I know about are interested in doing more to support the communication of science to the public and to support those people who are doing it.
Maureen mentioned earlier that it's important for young people to see scientists as real people. And, you know, I'm thinking about my education growing up. I had some great science teachers, but I never saw a scientist in the classroom. Nobody ever came to visit the school. Do you think that there's a disconnect there, that we're not, scientists are not visible enough in our culture? Andrew?
I think that's somewhat true. This is going to sound like a shameless plug, but that's one of the things we're trying to do with Darwin Day, is bring in scientists and have them speak both to the university community, but to the general public. So people can come next Saturday on the, I guess it's the 7th, and see real working scientists talking about their science and how much they love it, and see that they're just normal people doing great work.
Maureen?
And I should also point out that people can come and see real working scientists every Friday at the University of Iowa Department of Biology. We have seminars that are open to the public that biologists are giving. We also, I think there's an increasing effort in my lab group and in other people's labs to engage themselves in outreach and in being the people who go out and say, this is what scientists look like. So my lab group and I were, you know, people ranging from 16, 17 all the way up to my relatively senior age to go out to local schools, and we talk to them about science, and we actually do science with them. And so we show people, this is what scientists are like. They are young, they're female, they're not always wearing lab coats. They are people that you can talk to and that are fun and that have real lives outside of the very exciting science that they do.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. This is an email from David in Waukee with another perspective. He says, several years ago, a teaching colleague of mine in a local area high school polled his chemistry classes, the brightest juniors in the school, on their belief or disbelief in evolution. Way over half of his students said they did not believe in evolution. The year before, all those students took the required biology class where evolution is assumed and taught. So there's another teacher perspective. Bill is on the line in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call. It was stated by one of your guests, I believe it was Maureen, that she would not want to see a physician who did not believe or accept the theory of evolution. Should we apply the same standard to our politicians who are making decisions with regard to science that affect many lives in the direction of our country? And I suspect these are the same ones that don't believe in or accept the theory of global warming as well.
All right, Bill, I'll let someone else respond to that. Anybody?
I can start. Yeah. Bill, I think that's a great question. And what I would say is, for my own personal belief systems, no, I would not want to support a politician who didn't not just accept evolution or accept global climate change, but accepted science as an important force in society, as something that we needed to invest resources in. I personally would not want to support such a politician. I can't speak for others, but in terms of my own selfish wishes that are world becomes a better place, I hope that a lot of people also similarly support politicians who invest in science, because I think it's probably the most important way that we can make things better for ourselves and for our children and for the planet that we share with all sorts of other organisms in years to come.
Bill, thank you so much for your call. And I want to talk to Sean. You mentioned that this is a golden age for evolutionary biology. Expand on that a little bit for people who don't spend time reading science journalism and paying attention to this. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think our power to peer into the process and understand precisely how it works has just grown phenomenally. And one of the major domains of that is because of our ability to analyze DNA. In DNA is the record of the history of life on Earth, and in DNA is also the record of the adaptations that organisms have acquired as they've spread out across the globe and adapted to all sorts of habitats. And our ability to peer in there, including into human DNA, and to understand how we've fought off diseases or adapted to particular, you know, to high altitude in some cases, or to certain diets and things like this. This is, very, very accessible to us now. And so we really understand that those basic ingredients of the evolutionary process, which start with genetic variation, start with mutations that make us individually a little bit different, and that those mutations affect the properties of something that in us, an enzyme that digests the food or, you know, skin tone or whatever that might be, or resistance to a virus, that then that sets in motion this process where some people do better than others and are able to survive or prevail in certain habitats and not others. And we see this at every scale of life, from invisible viruses to large animals like ourselves. And in the last 10 or 15 years, researchers' abilities to pinpoint the exact genetic changes that underlie the diversity of life is incredibly powerful. So you're looking at essentially the forensic record of evolution, the smoking guns of evolution, that is the same sort of evidence that we rely on in the courtroom when we convict or exonerate people based on DNA evidence. So we just have this power at our fingertips. That coupled, I have to give a lot of nods out to the paleontology community, which is the uncovering of the fossil record has continued at great pace, and there's just been some fabulous discoveries over the last 20 years. Some of those were mentioned earlier, but the origin of birds from dinosaurs, numerous species in our lineage, in the origin of humans, early creatures that tell us about how animal life started adapting to land, things like that. So things that we couldn't have talked about, what I just riffed off with, we couldn't have talked about this stuff 15 years ago. Wouldn't be in textbooks, wouldn't be in newspaper articles or anything like that. So it's been a fabulous time to be an evolutionary biologist, and hopefully that will all show up in a more powerful curriculum.
Marie?
I wanted to continue on Sean's theme of giving a shout out to the various types of biology that have been important by also emphasizing a kind of biology that has actually been going on for centuries, which is people who study the organismal biology or ecology of organisms in the natural environments that they inhabit. And so this is a lot of what Darwin did. And it's by coupling this information on organismal ecology biology with these genomic data and the fossil data that we can really start to paint a complete picture of how life has evolved. And so we need all of these different types of biology, biologists, and scientists working together to understand the history and the future of life.
How much is there left to discover about evolution? What do you think, Sean?
Well, I think a tremendous amount. The history of life, we're still just, Darwin said, the crust of the earth is a vast museum. Right, and most of it has gone unsearched so far, and I think there's much to discover about the history of life. There's much to discover about what's going on in evolution today, because all sorts of organisms concern us, and we mentioned earlier, from things like Ebola to flu virus, and we need to understand the particulars of evolution in various ways. A lot more to discover about our own history, but I want to go back to what Maureen said. I think understanding the workings of nature in a large scale, what we would call ecology and how organisms interact, this is incredibly important. And it is the sort of thing that motivated Darwin, has motivated naturalists for a long time, and is really important to understanding the evolutionary process, but it's really important to our own self-interest. It's really important to the systems that we depend upon in the coming decades. So I think that there's a close alliance between what we would sort of call ecological and evolutionary thinking in understanding how life is changing on the planet, how it's been changing, and how it's going to change into the future, and what that means for us. And that's where you see a lot of concern on biologists' faces.
We could talk for a couple more hours about this, but I think this is an interesting final question. This is from Cindy in Story County. She says, these days, no matter what you believe, you can find someone on the internet who agrees with you. It's very easy to stick with internet sources who confirm your own beliefs, and some of those sources have a vested interest in spreading information that is not based on facts. Science education has to contend with that, but how? And who wants to take that first? How does science education deal with the fact that you can, in this age of information, you can reinforce whatever you want if you look in the right places? Sean?
It starts in the classroom. You know, it's training teachers well, equipping them with the best information. And I think also training teachers better in these disciplines. It's not been a big tradition in the country that K through 12 teachers have a degree in a science discipline. They tend to have a degree in education. And I think we can equip teachers and make them more comfortable with the whole world of science than they may be now on average. And I think, and then some of that passion is gonna rub off on their students. I think it's K through 12 education is, if we don't pay attention to that, we really don't have much hope of countering the rest of this.
And does anybody want to, did you want to add anything to that, Andrew?
Well, I mean, related to that, I guess that I think about science really as a way of understanding the natural world and a way to ask questions about the natural world. It's like a method. Educating people and getting people to understand that that's what science is and that it's a way of looking at the world that doesn't depend on, you know, miracles or explanations that are made up. Gets people to appreciate how important it is, I think, and how amazing scientific discovery is. And I think just getting people to feel that way is starts, again, in the classroom.
Maureen, did you want a final word?
I might take that even a step broader and say, on what Andrew said, is that scientific thinking, it's not just about science. It's a way of shaping how you think and how you approach the world. And I think teaching anybody the principles of how logical thought works and how we can generate new information about the world will make them a better person who's better equipped to live the rest of their life as an adult.
Mm-hmm. Maureen Niemann, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maureen Niemann is Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa, President-elect of Darwin Day in Iowa City. Andrew Forbes, thank you.
Thanks, Charity.
University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Biology and Co-Academic Coordinator of the U of I's Environmental Science Program. Sean Carroll, thank you.
Thanks, Charity.
Sean Carroll is an evolutionary biologist and author. His most recent book is Brave Genius. He will be speaking at the Iowa City Darwin Day celebration. You can find out more. You can follow the link on our Facebook page. You can also go to iowacitydarwinday.org. The events, it's not just one day, coming up February 5th through the 7th. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, how cell phones have radically altered our lives. Could you live without yours? Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.